And when we get really cross, driven to extremity, we start throwing our food. Ahead of the Australian election, Egg Boy, he entered our world. Then there was Egg Girl, as you recall, rolling one off the prime ministerial bonce. In the UK, there have been bans on the sale of milkshakes. Suddenly the projectile of choice as the Brexit kerfuffle fueled tempers ahead of that European parliamentary election. But using food to make a statement, that's nothing new. The people have no bread. Let them eat cake. Did she really say that, Marie Antoinette? Perhaps most commonly in history, food has been the source of the conflict rather than the weapon. A food riot, that's a riot over subsistence, not a mass of people throwing eggs and potatoes. Let's dip into this history with Sarah Wasberg-Johnson. She's a food historian, a museum professional who joins us from upstate New York via Skype. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
There's something quite sort of direct and intimate about using food as a means of protest. I mean, is this a thing which has always been part of our protest vocabulary?
I think so. I mean, if you look in theater culture in particular, if you think about Elizabethan England, the Globe Theater, Shakespearean plays, and people in the pit, if they're unhappy with a performance, they might be throwing some rotted cabbages at the actors. So I think food as a form of protest or expression of discontent has been around for a while.
I'm immediately thinking of people at medieval times in stocks as punishment, being pelted with rotten cabbages.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that occurred as well. And of course, if we go way back to biblical times, of course, they weren't using food. They were using stones when they're stoning people. But food definitely, it's a weapon that isn't particularly necessarily painful or injurious. So I think people like to use it to humiliate rather than injure.
That's such a good point. And what could be more humiliating than being smacked with an egg that then runs down your face? Or as we saw in the UK so recently, politicians in their suits try to look all important, getting splattered by a milkshake, and that immediately makes them a subject of fun.
Right. And it elicits a very negative reaction because, of course, no one likes to be publicly humiliated. Right. So yes, it sort of is a very provoking act as well.
The other side of this coin, and this is perhaps where this discussion of food and protest, it gets truly interesting and perhaps a little bit more serious, I guess, is where people have protested around that issue of food rather than using food to make their point.
Right. So throughout history, food riots have been a common response to food scarcity or food price increases. So, you know, bread riots dating back to, you know, medieval cities all the way up to the price increases in places like Italy during the recession in 2008, or more recently in Venezuela, right? There's a serious lack of food in Venezuela, so people are sort of taking to the streets to deal with that. So it's usually riots are most often born out of desperation from food scarcity, but there are also a number of examples throughout history of food riots and food boycotts that sort of devolve into riots happening because of very rapid inflation, especially around staple foods. And that's something that definitely happened in Australia during the First World War. There were high cost of living protests in August to September of 1917, in part because there was a very significant increase in the price of food, while at the same time, Australian food stocks that had been purchased by the British but were prevented from export by German U-boats were sort of rotting in warehouses at the wharves. And so people were saying, why is our food so expensive when there's frozen meat and wheat rotting and it can't get to England? So there was a lot of unrest, political unrest and protest about that situation.
There's something interesting. I mean, there's a common element in this of people being denied something so fundamental You know, there's a great sense of injustice around the food riot, unrest around food.
That's definitely the thing that was happening during the First World War. Not only in Australia, it happened in the United States, which was one of the first countries in the year 1917. In February and March, women, Jewish working class women of the Lower East Side, had a boycott, and that later devolved into a riot over skyrocketing prices for staples like potatoes and onions. Cabbage, you know, were doubling, tripling in price in just a matter of weeks while wages remained the same. There were other food boycotts that year in Boston and Philadelphia, and then, of course, also in England, and most infamously, perhaps, in Russia, right? That devolved into the Russian Revolution.
Yes, well, that's a fairly significant moment of protest.
Yes, but that started as a women's bread protest. Like, they took to the streets demanding bread, and a lot of these protests were led by women, which is sort of a unique happenstance in protest and riot history, I guess you could think of it that way.
Well, I mean, using the Russian example, I suppose it puts me in mind of Marxist theory. And this, I mean, food is a great example of alienation. It's a great example of something which used to be intrinsic to people's lives, which through social development is subcontracted to other parties who then use that either commercially or sometimes even as a tool of social repression.
Right, and that did essentially occur after the Russian Revolution into the 1920s, with poor rural farmers in Russia were starving to death because the Bolshevik Party was taking their harvests to feed party loyalists in the cities. So definitely state or even capitalist control of food sources and food supply has caused a lot of strife over the years. So,
yeah, I'm putting in mind here of things like potato famines in Ireland, for example. I mean, instance after instance where there is a group of people, often quite close to the production of the food, who are then detached from it and kept away from the proceeds of their work.
Yes, that is a common theme. I mean, you see it in India around that time period as well. It doesn't happen quite as much in the United States because we had less state control of our farming. So usually the farmers in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century were among the better fed because they had the land to raise their own food. And we did not have state price controls, although they did implement some quasi-price controls during the First World War. Mm. But they didn't like to call them that. Herbert Hoover, who was the food administrator at that time, was a great capitalist and believed in capitalism and didn't really want to call it price controls, even though that's really what they were doing.
Who was it who had a chicken in every pot? Which president was that?
Yeah, I think that was Hoover, wasn't it?
I think it may well have been Hoover, if I remember my Annie, which is the reference I'm struggling for. I mean, it's an interesting thing because I suspect by the time that people are socially angry over food, we've reached a real point of crisis.
Well, food riots almost never start out as riots. They usually start as relatively peaceful protests or boycotts or things like that sort of the violence, once you get a group of desperate people together, the violence sort of erupts and it devolves into a riot. But often they're starting as political protests where they're gathering in front of political arenas, trying to get attention of politicians. The Lower East Side ladies in New York City were gathering in front of the mayor's office, trying to get a meeting with him to sort of resolve, can we open up, you know, places where starving babies can get milk and bread and other things that were people just literally could not afford.
You mentioned the Russian Revolution as being sort of the downstream consequence of action around food. Examples where that sort of food riot has brought constructive social change, where it has led to a movement which was for the better of all concerned?
Most of the riots that were happening in 1917, particularly in the United States, were solved by our entrance into the First World War. And also a lot in the United States, most of these riots were happening in February or March, which is a time of year when food is not necessarily abundant anyway. And so I think once we got into the spring, you know, the United States joined the war in April of 1917. So things kind of shifted around a little bit. Wages started to go back up as war mobilization got underway. So men who were working in industrial factories, their wages started to rise, which helped them cope with that a little bit. But one thing that the boycotts did do in New York City in particular is that food purveyors had sort of a choice between their produce rotting at the rail stations or lowering their prices. So in that instance, the boycott itself was effective. And I believe in Australia, in Melbourne, they did pass some legislation to sort of free up some of the food supplies that were meant for England that obviously were not going to make it there because of transportation issues, to sort of alleviate that a little bit. But one thing that's interesting, I'm talking about the Russian Revolution, is that socialists were involved in organizing a lot of these lower and working class families who were unable to afford this food. So they would organize protests and marches and things like that, and then they would kind of devolve into riots eventually because nothing was changing. But I thought that was an interesting perspective that political socialists were involved in helping to organize these people.
Now, just a last point, Sarah, and drawing here on your expertise to perhaps resolve perhaps the most famous food-related protest quote in history that attributed to Marie Antoinette, "Let them eat cake."
Oh, goodness. I think...
Do you think she said that?
I don't think she actually said that. I think that I've read that was a mistranslation. I'd have to fact check that to be absolutely sure. But I feel like Marie Antoinette gets a little bit of a bad rap. But nobody likes ultra wealthy despot when ordinary people are starving in the streets. That was true in pre-revolution France, and that was true in pre-revolution Russia as well.
Let's be charitable. She probably said something like, I will happily take them this cake that I'm about to eat.
I don't think it went quite that far. I mean, she liked to play at being a peasant, so I think she was a little bit sympathetic toward the plight of people, but not quite that far, perhaps.
Sarah, thank you so very much.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Sarah Mossberg-Johnson, a food historian. She's a museum professional in upstate New York.